It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Let us not be merely spectators at our own lives, but also those who are really living them. It is so easy to let others live important parts of our lives for us, to leave us living second-hand lives. If we take from them their beliefs, their values, their ambitions, and their sense of our duties, we may be living their lives. And then who will live ours? We play many of life's games by others' rules because we're a social species and must learn to play well with others. It won't always go our way, but in other areas, when our integrity and authenticity are involved, we need to honor our own higher values, for no one else can do that. Allegiance to our highest values is what we have to offer to our world. It's what we bring to the table. Let us be sure that our commitments and allegiances are to people, relationships, and causes that are worthy of us. We must care that the laws and customs of our country serve us, serve the needs of most of our brothers and sisters, rather than just the few who may have fought or bought their way into making our rules. And let us remember that life is a game of give and take, cooperation and compassion, and is very seldom meant to be about us. Yet we too are here. We too are among the players. And sometimes the ball is in our court. Then it is our move. Amen.
The word seduction is an interesting word. Most people are surprised to learn that it has the same root as the word education, as well as induction, deduction, conduction, abduction, and all the other ductions. The root, the D-U-C, means to lead. The prefixes tell you how and where you're being led. So education means to lead out of yourself and to be brought up into something bigger, sort of the opposite of reduction, to be made smaller. Induction is to be led into something, the Hall of Fame, the Army. Conduction means to be led through something, like electricity is led through a wire, or like a conductor leads musicians through a piece, and so on. And seduction means to be led astray. Led astray to be used for someone else's agenda at your expense. It's an especially tacky form of deception. However, we love stories of deception and seduction. They've been some of our favorite stories in history. Think of the Trojan horse, where the Greeks gave this great gift to the Trojans, this big horse on wheels, and the Trojans said, "Oh, thank you. It's nice to see that you respect our military superiority." And they brought the horse inside the city, and that night all the soldiers came down from inside the horse and destroyed the city. That's seduction. You're taking in, thinking that this is about you. And then you learn too late that you were just taken to the cleaners, or worse. But it's one of our favorite stories in its perverse way. I can name a few examples, and you can think of hundreds of others. How about the line, "Will you walk into my parlor?" said a spider to a fly. The spider in this poem from 1829, so that one's been with us a while, lured the gullible fly into its web by flattering it and then ate it. And the moral of the poem was about the fly's foolishness. Or these famous six lines, which probably three-quarters of you know by heart. I won't ask for a show of hands. "The time has come," the walrus said, "to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings." If you know this poem from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, you know that the walrus's words had absolutely nothing to do with what was going on. The words came at the moment in the game of bait and switch, when the move was being made from bait to switch. They had lured a bunch of oysters to join them for a long walk on the beach, scenic, pretty. The oysters were looking for fun and adventure. The walrus and the carpenter were looking for supper. The walk on the beach was the advertising brochure. The reality was that the oysters were dead meat. Now, you could say this was about the oysters' foolishness, but haven't we all been deceived or seduced by somebody this week? People who play the spider or the walrus and the carpenter can use words, can use language to cast a spell, set up kind of an alternate reality, and we are drawn in as easily as flies and oysters. It's amazing. It's not the way we're used to thinking about either ourselves or language. We're used to hearing people talk about language as the great pride of our species, the magnificent achievement that sets us apart from all these lower animals, the key to culture, and so on and so forth. But if we think of human language as just one means of communicating, and that culture as a non-genetic way of shaping the social world we're living in, then it's clear that most animals have cultures, all social animals do, and that all animals have means of communicating. We just make different noises. There is a nice and somewhat seductive story about using language that I want to share with you. It's about a chimpanzee named Nim Chimpsky. And he communicated with humans using American Sign Language. So you have an interesting ability to communicate in the same language across very closely related species. Sometimes he used signs in very creative ways. At least one of them, the sign for bite, seemed to take the place of actually biting someone when he was angry. Nim learned the signs for bite and angry from seeing a picture of Zero Mostel, the actor, biting a hand and making an angry face. A little later, Amy, his trainer, began the process of transferring him to his new trainer, Laura. But Nim didn't want to leave Amy, and he tried to drive Laura away. When Laura kept trying to pick him up, the chimpanzee acted as if he were going to bite her. His mouth was pulled back over his bare teeth, and he approached Laura with his hair raised. These are dangerous signs. But instead of biting, he repeatedly made the bite sign with sign language right in her face. And he had a fierce expression while he made it. Then, after making this sign for a few minutes, he seemed to relax. And a few minutes later, he transferred to Laura without any signs of aggression. On other occasions, Nim was observed to sign both bite and angry as a warning. This is really pretty remarkable. Nim Chimpsky made, in a small way, the transition we've made through our language, substituting the word for the real thing. using language rather than actions to express strong emotions. We hear this and we think, well, that's a good thing, that he could just tell her he wanted to bite her without actually biting her, especially since a chimpanzee's canine teeth are as dangerous as a panther's. In our own species, we also use words this way, of course, talking things out, using diplomacy instead of war, like we once did. Well, we have some history in with current. Most psychotherapy is about getting clients out of their heads and into incorporating their feelings. Language can create an alternate world and seduce us into it, often triggering immensely powerful emotions. You can think of things like jihad. You can think of things like war, gang warfare, anything where humans have the equivalent of a chimpanzee with its hair up and its fangs bared. And we're doing it because we're playing a role in a story. But we do this all the time. We can cry at the story of a spider dying in Charlotte's Web. We can be emotionally drawn into stories like Babe or Shrek or Jungle Book or Bambi or 100 other comedies, tragedies, movies that you can think of. Language, especially in stories and advertisements and propaganda, has an amazing power to seduce us into a world that isn't there and to play with our emotions, completely bypassing the part of our brain that knows this isn't true. I know you don't doubt that, but in case you were thinking of doubting that, just a few minutes ago, we all seemed to buy the idea of spiders, flies, and walruses that talk, and oysters that take a walk along the beach. 16 years ago, I had a powerful experience of just how easily and quickly this works at a two-hour program I'll never forget. I was in Michigan, but the program was done by an anthropologist who came from Austin, named Robbie Davis Floyd, who at the time was with UT. Her program was called A User's Guide to Ritual. She said ritual has two parts, the vehicle and the loading. The vehicle, she said, which is what moves us along, is neutral. It has no necessary meaning at all. The loading carries the agenda. And we are almost incapable of distinguishing between the two of them when they're put together. And that's how we're taken in by rituals. Now, she was marvelous at controlling this audience of about 70 professors of religion, psychology, anthropology, sociology, ministers, and chaplains. So it's a pretty skeptical audience to be making strong claims to. And she played us like a fiddle. She repeatedly told us she can tell us a story that would take half of us to tears, even though we knew there was not a word of truth to it. And furthermore, she'd say, all the graduate degrees in this room can't stop me. After a few minutes of this baiting, and she was very good at it, the level of anger in the room was palpable. And someone finally said, between clenched teeth, then do it! She laughed. And she said, well, she couldn't do it in this atmosphere. I thought, you made this atmosphere. She said, first we'd need to clear our emotional palates and our minds. We'd have to get rid of this angry mood and get to kind of a neutral place before we could talk about experiments. She said we needed a mindless activity, something we could do without thinking at all that might be fun or at least goofy. She proposed that we all sing a song together, a song to which all 70 of us would already know the words. And she asked for suggestions. Now, if you think about it, and we didn't, there really aren't many songs that a room full of people would all know the words to. And there were very few suggestions, and they'll probably be about the same any time you try this. Finally, we decided, by a show of hands, this is very democratic, we decided on My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. And so she had us sing it. It was a very goofy thing to hear 70 people sing "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean" in that room. After we'd sung it, she asked if anyone felt anything. And she got a laugh, and someone said, "Nausea." Someone else said, "A desperate need for voice lessons." But the trap had been set. "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean" was the vehicle. Then she loaded it in 30 seconds, which I'll do for you. The only other fact you need to know is that this was April 1991, just a couple months after the first Gulf War. Here's what she said. "Your daughter, your wife, your beloved, Bonnie, is in the U.S. Army in Iraq. 3 days ago, her platoon was captured. You cannot get any information from the Army because they don't have any information. You don't know whether she has been raped, mutilated, killed, or all three. You haven't slept in 3 days, and you have never been so scared in your life." She paused 5 seconds and said, "Let's sing the song." We sang it in just exactly this mood, very slowly, very quietly. There was audible sobbing in the room. We all knew it was a fiction, but everyone in the room was emotionally affected as we sang the words, "Bring back, bring back, oh bring back my Bonnie to me." Now her point, and I've never felt a point made more powerfully, I don't think, was that all it takes to seduce us is a story that hooks us, and we can be hooked by amazingly simple stories. Truth has nothing to do with it. Now, you can read animal studies and say that dogs and birds and chimpanzees and fish and all kinds of other animals trick each other, but it seems that through language, we alone can be taken into make-believe worlds this far removed from reality, this easily, and this powerfully. We are a propagandist's dream. I remember a wonderful old professor, 25 years ago, wonderful man, who met with students to play Dungeons and Dragons. This very professorial man would dress up in what looked like a ratty brown medieval monk's robe with hood. His wife made it for him. He would join the students in their costumes and pass through an imaginative doorway into the world of Dungeons and Dragons every Sunday night. Was the Dungeons and Dragons world real? If you just watch him, you'd have to say it's real to him. His eyes sparkled. He came alive. And he was no longer a quiet little man, very hard of hearing, and with a speech impediment. He was the dungeon master. It was real. But of course it wasn't real. It's this disconnection from the real world around us which lets us be manipulated into fantasies that can become dangerous. Because as seductive as they are, when we enter into an imaginative world, something's been left out. Now, there's a metaphor invented by my favorite philosopher, the one I did my dissertation on, Ludwig Wittgenstein, that captures some of what's going on here and why it's potentially so misleading. And it's also kind of a fun metaphor. Here's what he wrote. Imagine this game. I call it tennis without a ball. The players move around on a tennis court, just as in tennis, and they even have rackets, but no ball. Each one reacts to his partner's strokes as if, or more or less, as if a ball had caused his reaction. Maneuvers. The umpire, who must have an eye for the game, decides in questionable cases whether a ball has gone into the net, out of bounds, or so on. This game is obviously quite similar to tennis, and yet, on the other hand, it is fundamentally different. It is fundamentally different because without a real ball, without real world constraints on our imaginations, our movements just aren't what they seem to be. The Maibani experience is what lets us get hooked by seeing a photo of a starving child, hearing stories of disasters like Katrina. We enter into the story's world immediately, we respond emotionally, and that can drive our behavior. We send money or we offer help. And when that happens, we think that's a good thing that we can be moved so easily. But those who make their living influencing us through stories and ads and political rhetoric know that they can play bait and switch just as easily and far more profitably. This game of bait and switch is not a human invention. This isn't a sophisticated game. You can find examples of it all over the animal world, too. You may have seen pictures of anglerfish, those big, ugly fish that look like a pile of rocks, though they probably don't think of themselves as ugly. And they have this thing dangling in front of their snout that looks like a worm. They're angling. And then they sit there looking like rocks, and a little fish swims by, and it comes to take the worm. The anglerfish opens its mouth and eats them. Now, this is the fish version of a spider luring a fly into its parlor. Bait and switch. And earlier in this sermon series, I told you the story about adolescent chimpanzees who would lure a chicken behind a wall with food. Then once the chickens come after the food and is behind the wall, they beat it with sticks. It's a game they seem to have invented to fight boredom. This is a story of chimps playing bait and switch with a chicken. The bait is, we're going to feed you. And the switch is, we're going to beat you. We can fool other animals, but we can even fool ourselves through language, which seems to be a fairly high achievement of some sort. I once had a professor, everyone has known people like this. He was a theologian, a Calvinist theologian, a brilliant, absolutely brilliant scholar. And his excellent lectures were filled with lessons about how the God of the Bible was above all else a God of radical love. I can still hear him saying that. Very pretty words. But in his treatment of some of his students, one of whom I knew well, he could be a petty and vindictive little man. In his mind, he was an agent of his God of radical love. I absolutely believe that. In his behavior, some of us just saw a mean and hateful little man. He had used religious language to pull the wool over his own eyes, though in his case, not over the eyes of anyone else. Now, in religion, this has been maybe the key difference between prophets and priests, sages and priests, for thousands of years. Priests tell us, or you could say the official church, the organized religion, the agents of the institution, this sort of thing, the protectors of the orthodoxy, the keepers of the flame, those folks. Priests call us to believe as we're told, to recite the creeds or repeat the rituals as we're taught, because that's what's required to belong, and then you're okay. Prophets and sages say it doesn't much matter what we believe or what rituals we practice, but only how we treat one another. We use words to create imaginary worlds where we can see the world made small. It's too big. And we make it small in our stories, and then we can find an imaginative place in that plot that gives us meaning and purpose. You could say this drives every religion history. But the farther we got drawn into the story and drawn away from the awareness of what our behaviors might be doing to ourselves and to others, the more easily we can be led astray through the bait and switch tactics of those who know how to use language to play us. The chaos of life is given form by virtue of what we choose to omit. And language often omits the cost of what we have excluded, including the effect of our actions on ourselves or others. Then we're in the land of seduction, where those who create the stories can demand and get obedience, like the Wizard of Oz, where chimps lure chickens to their doom, where the language of the walrus and the carpenter has no connection at all to their actions, intended only to trick and to trap. And all this can happen because language is often like a game of tennis without a ball, without emotional connections to actual people or the environment around us. Using language of high ideals and emotional stories to cover over actions that are greedy, imperialistic, murderous, bigoted, hateful, is playing bait and switch at a very high level. Wrapping low motives in high phrases, covering nastiness with nationalism, or ungodly actions in godly chatter, covering recklessness with rhetoric, these are examples of the seduction of language, of how easily and effectively we are taken in every how many days. That's how language can be like a Trojan horse. Now, here's the truth in advertising part. The language we use to build character, to raise our sights, the language we use in education and religion, the language I'm using here every Sunday, is also trying to take us in and also trying to lead us somewhere. There's always an agenda. All the best religious stories are trying to educate us, to lead us into bigger selves, and to counter all the other stories that have taken us in, those stories that play tennis without a ball, which have misdirected us to avoid looking at the costs of what we're doing. Let's take just a few. You can all think of dozens more. We're seduced by a phrase like freedom and democracy, because they're wonderful words and we believe in both of them. But when we're not connecting that phrase with the actions taking under its umbrella, we're playing tennis without a ball. And some of the actions conducted under the umbrella phrase of freedom and democracy have included invading Iraq. There's nothing here you don't know. Selling off their assets, taking control of their oil, invading the country based on complete fictions about weapons of mass destruction, perhaps killing over 650,000 of their citizens, men, women, and children, losing over 3,100 of our soldiers, not counting 20,000 who've been wounded. That's the picture from inside the spider's parlor. The picture of the game of bloody tennis played with the ball. And I think it has nothing at all to do with freedom or democracy. That's how we're seduced by language. Another fine-sounding phrase is free market economy. Who could be against that? We believe in freedom, but behind the rhetoric, we can read in the stories of our papers for the last many years a brutalizing economy. That looks like an economy of corporate greed that moves to limit our economy to policies, trade, and tax structures that benefit them at our expense. That economy isn't free. It's imprisoned in corporate headquarters. Or another one, the Clear Skies Act of 2003. I knew you'd like that one. Nobody could be against clear skies. We love clear skies. So, of course, we passed the Clear Skies Act, and inside that spider's parlor, we see companies polluting our skies with abandon while seducing us with simple words. Recently in the news this week, we have our governor saying he believes with all his heart that he should insist that all sixth grade girls in Texas be forced to be vaccinated with a drug made by the Merck Pharmaceutical Company. Now, meanwhile, on the pages of at least other newspapers, we've been reading for over a week that Merck has finally agreed to stop paying lobbyists in about 20 states to pressure or bribe state officials to stick young girls with their vaccine. The language of vaccinating girls to protect them from cancer sounds noble. until you realize that our governor and others are apparently saying it because they've been rewarded for doing so or promised future rewards by Merck, the company that manufactures the drug and stands to make a killing. We need to have a healthy suspicion of people, including preachers, who wrap their message in idealistic language. Don't swallow it whole. We need to be very wary of abstractions and the appeal to high ideals until we see what behaviors are hiding behind them, where the ball is. It's good to have leaders, depending on where they're leading us. But what we want and what we need, I think, is to educate ourselves into a more aware and compassionate perspective, to induct one another into a more compassionate perspective and into the company of the better angels of our nature, to conduct ourselves and our nation according to the highest ideals that would treat others as we want to be treated, to resist being abducted by alien agendas that can lead us into blind alleys and leave us with our tears, our regrets, and perhaps the compromise of our very souls. For that's what can happen. Just yesterday, I read Maureen Dowd's editorial in the New York Times where she chastises John McCain for being so eagerly seduced by anything and anyone who might get him more votes. Her final line, her punchline, was, "Sometimes I miss John McCain, even when I'm with him." That's what we don't want. To miss ourselves even when we're alone. We don't want to miss the richness of our relationships even when we're together. We don't want to miss what's noblest about America while we're in it. And we don't want to miss the chance for an empowered and authentic life even while we're living it. I think I've found that ball missing from the game, the ball that brings the whole game into the real world where we have a say about who gets to hit it and how. The ball is in our court.